Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride.
Hello, this is Jeff Patterson, and we are here for our third episode of the Three Horsemen podcast for December. Good Lord, what were we thinking? This is insane. Anyways, I've got with me my usual co-hosts. First and foremost, I will introduce to you Mr. Fred Kish.
Hi, this is Fred Kish, and to relax today, I baked 360 biscotti, one for each listener of this podcast.
Excellent. That works for me. And also with us is John Stevens.
All I did was laundry. Crap.
But did you do it one for each listener, though? So
I don't think I have 360 pieces of clothing, even if I throw in the linens. I have to sit like a sheet would have to like symbolize five people and a sock two people or something.
Wow. And I have to remind all of our listeners that this is, in fact, the first episode of the Three Horsemen podcast that we decided to have on with us tonight, our very special guest, and the man, quite frankly, without whom none of this would have been possible, Mr. Patrick Hester.
I am your father.
I had to wait a really long time to do that.
Oh, excellent.
Really, really long time.
Wow.
Come on.
For those of you who don't know, the reason the Three Horsemen started, for those who haven't been listening since the beginning, I knew them when they were cool, man, was Patrick's schedule did not allow him to
breathe,
throw up as much content as he wanted to at the height of Hugo voting season.
I was in hell.
Yeah.
I was. That was a horrible time in my life.
Yeah. So we elected to help out by throwing in saying, hey, let's throw in at least some content they can call the SF Signal podcast so that it'll be fresh in the minds of Hugo voters.
And then when you spun it out and you called it your own thing and then you tried to put those episodes in your own feed, it really confused iTunes.
Oh. Yeah.
We don't talk about iTunes around here. iTunes is a trauma. Yeah.
So it's a lesson to all you wannabe podcasters out there. If you're actually spinning out from something that's already established, make sure you dot your I's. Patrick, how are you today?
I'm doing well. I made chili and cornbread today. So awesome. And I did laundry.
Ooh.
Yeah. Ooh. I just cut up an apple. What the hell do I do with my life?
Yeah. I posted on Facebook early this like around 11 or 12 that I had dumped everything in the crock pot for the chili and found out that Sarah Chorn had done the same thing. She'd already started a crock pot meal as well. So apparently it's crock pot Sunday.
Yeah, I had beef in the crock pot for goulash today.
Very
So as you can tell, our subject tonight is crock pots. We're going to be talking about our favorite science fiction crock pot recipes.
Yes.
Yes. I remember that scene in The Star's My Destination when he... Oh, sorry.
Hey, now, come on. You know there's no food in science fiction.
But yeah. Well, I was about to say, I mean, John, what does the crock pot mean? You know, what does it... What is it...
What does it represent?
Tell us about ourselves? So we invited Patrick on for a couple of reasons. Number one, this is probably, oh God, I hope so, the last recording we do for 2014. And we wanted to talk about, you know, last year we talked about what we had on our gift list, both things we're getting for other people and our own wish list. And we wanted to sort of play on that a little bit. And then we wanted to talk about comics a little bit because we all chat about them. And Patrick does do a bit of a column about comics once in a while. So,
mm-hmm. Yep. Over on Kirkus.
And since we... since we managed to pollute Fred this year, I thought it'd be a nice way to go out. So, Patrick, just in case people don't know who you are, tell us who you are.
I am the Hugo Award-winning podcast producer of the Campbell Award-winning Mer Lafferty's I Should Be Writing. No, actually, I'm not. I don't do that anymore. But I'm the podcast producer and host for the SF Signal podcast. I'm the producer co-host for the Functional Nerds podcast with John Anilio. And I have done I Should Be Writing in the Past for Mer Lafferty. I have turned down more invitations to be podcast producers than you guys could possibly count at this point, because I just don't have the time to do it anymore, because what I really want to do is write. And so I write science fiction and fantasy, and I send it out, and because I collect rejection letters. That's apparently what I do. I blog a little bit. I have ATFMB is where kind of I am online. So ATFMB.com, all things from my brain. And then I did Twitter.com/ATFMB and Facebook.com/ATFMB. And Kirkus approached me about doing something for them, and they didn't want the standard science fiction column. No offense to people who write standard science fiction columns, but they already had DiNardo writing the SF Signal column on Kirkus, and they had LibTac doing sort of military sci-fi and the history of sci-fi column, and they wanted something different, and I had a conversation with an editor who is no longer there, and we basically said, she said, well, what about comic books? And I said, well, I think comic books would be great. She says, well, they have to have literary tie-in, you know, to stick with our brand. And luckily, she's gone now, and I don't do that anymore. I'm because it was getting really, really hard to find literary comic books and graphic novels, you know, or things that were tied to it. There's only so many tie-ins at this point. Yeah. I know that people are still doing it. Like Yen Press is, if I'm not mistaken, is an imprint of Orbit. I think it's Orbit. Who publishes Brent Weeks and Gail Carriger? Is it Orbit? Anyway, Yen Press is their manga line, and so they've done like Gail Carriger's Parasol Protectorate. They did Brent Weeks's the first trilogy, the Night Angel books. So they adapted those, and from then, you know, it's kind of hard because it's almost like going into Disney, because they're looking for things that they can get without having to pay anybody. So there's lots of like Wizard of Oz and Grimm's Fairy Tales and that kind of stuff. But lately I've been able to branch out and do some other things and do some media tie-ins because I have a different editor now. And this editor will actually email me and say, hey, there's a new Spider-Man movie coming out. Can you do something about Spider-Man? Mm-hmm. Sure. So that's kind of how the Kirkus posts came about.
Well, that sounds like fun. And they've been good columns.
Yeah, I try.
So as comic columns go, which do tend to run the gamut of good to simply awful. So
I still try to keep it science fictiony and do very few superhero stuff if I can manage.
Excellent. Which, as you know, I've been a big champion of. So I think the question that we all have now that you're on is seriously, why the hell do you keep inviting us on?
I invite. You're talking about on SF Signal?
Yes.
So on SF Signal, I the rules are constantly changing as well. The Functional Nerds podcast was started because John Anilio and I wanted to do an SF Signal podcast, and we didn't think that DiNardo would say yes. So we went off and started the Functional Nerds. And when we did that, it was to prove the concept and prove that we could actually produce a podcast and be entertaining, and then take it to DiNardo and say, hey, look, don't you want to host this? But by the time we got to that point, we were comfortable. We also realized that we had a different brand and we could do different things in science fiction and fantasy. So we decided not to take the Functional Nerds to SF Signal, and we actually pitched essentially taking content from the Mind Melds and just doing like these weekly Mind Melds with people and doing news tidbits. And it was going to be a very short podcast. It's going to be 15 minutes long at the max. And of course that's never going to happen. You give me a microphone and I'm not going to shut up. And so when we first sat down with John, said, you know, who would we invite? He's like, well, I think we should always include the irregulars. And I said, oh, that's a great idea. And then it kind of evolved into, we love going to conventions, right? Literary cons and sci-fi cons. And we love to be at the panels and see these people talking about the stuff that's, you know, it's the whole thing where you go to work and you're the 9-to-5 person and you're surrounded by all these people who don't have a freaking clue who you are or what you do. And if you go too far down the Star Wars rant about the lightsaber, they don't, you know, their eyes gloss over and they're like, wow, you know, you're just weird. So you have to go to these literary conventions and sci-fi conventions and be amongst your people and be able to have the same conversations that you want to have, right? And so it kind of evolved into, let's do these panels and let's have all the regulars on and we'll mix it up a little bit and we'll add, you know, some authors here and there. And so really the list has grown. I want to say that my weekly, well, when I'm on track and on target and I'm actually sending stuff out, but my weekly target of people is about 50. And that includes regular contributors to SF Signal. It includes a lot of authors. So you'll get like, Django Wexler is now a contributor as well. But Django, Gail Carriger, Ailey Martinez, Delilah Dawson, you know, folks who don't necessarily actually contribute to the site, but they're friendly to us and they like us and they want to come on. And so we just started adding them. And to go back to your original question, why do I keep inviting you guys on? You're on the list because you always come with good content, good answers. You bring a lot to the table. You have a great sense of humor. And of course you reply to the email.
Oh. And I always eat a dictionary before we start.
Yes.
Very important ritual.
For I always say it was a year, but DiNardo says it wasn't for a year. But for a year, I did a lot of editing at SF Signal and to give him a break. That's actually how I managed to get on the ballot for the Hugo Award the first time, was because I was editing everything. And there were two posts that would come in that always made me go, oh, shit. This is gonna be a long one, and it was the mind melts, and it was whatever John Stevens was contributing, because I knew number one, you can't just scan a John Stevens post, right? You try to scan it, and you're screwed. You're gonna get so lost so quickly. You have to read it, and then the motherfucker makes you think, right? Because now you're reading and you're going, oh, I didn't even realize that there were those kind of themes. That's really deep. It's like, wow. He belongs in the Village or something, like in New York, because he's just so deep. He needs a show on NPR. And then, you know, by the time you're done reading it, it's 12:30 and DiNardo's, you know, dinging you and texting you and stuff going, where are the posts? Why aren't they scheduled yet? It's like, oh, there was a John Stevens post. He's like, oh, okay. Was it good? Did you read it? Yeah, I read it.
That was that actually got snuck in as a joke during the Hugo acceptance.
Yes, it did. I had
several people in the row in front of me turn around and stare at me when I broke out in laughter when that was said. They just looked at me like, "Wow, we missed something there, didn't we?" So
the year before, apparently people couldn't hear me. I don't think I was close enough to the microphone. So a lot of my jokes didn't go very far. Shauna McGuire laughed. She heard them. So I wasn't going to be there, which really, really seriously bummed me out that I couldn't be there when the podcast got nominated again. But I was determined in that speech to thank as many people as I possibly could. They changed the rules, and so you couldn't have more than like three people, I think, on the ballot or something like that. Or you only get three awards, I think is the way it works. So there's only three Hugos per category because of Squeakcast, really. You know, when they had five or six or seven people, however many on there, they decided to change the rules so that there can only be three awards in any category. And I didn't know how to do that. And DiNardo and JP France were very sincere in wanting it to just be me. But I wanted to make sure that as many people got mentioned in the speech as possible. So that's why I did that.
Well, it was awesome. And we all appreciated it.
Cool. Good.
So since this is...
Absolutely.
What?
I said absolutely. That was great.
Good.
So since this is the end of the year, we wanted to discuss some things that may have popped up on wish lists or gift lists for people of the nerdier variety, or who are just into the fantastic in general.
Do you guys maintain like Amazon wish lists for yourself?
I do.
1,475 items. I mean, yes. Sorry.
Do you make them public? Do you ever like publicize them?
Yeah, mine are.
Do you have to do that intentionally, or does it just?
I think it's default public.
Oh yeah, mine's public. I'm actually looking at it right now, almost as if I took a few things from it for this podcast.
Yeah, I've always had one up primarily because for years, my family and my wife never knew what the hell to get me because my tastes were all over the place. So
I've lived with that for years myself. And did you ever find yourself, Jeff, going, I don't get it. I'm so easy.
Yeah. No, I understood the conundrum that they found themselves in, but my mother was notorious for saying, hey, Jeff liked Star Wars a lot back in 1977, so I will buy him Star Wars things.
Right.
And they were always like, you know, t-shirts or Lego sets or glasses, you know, like drink glasses that had like, you know, Clone Wars characters on them and stuff like that. And it was always, God bless them, but you gotta, making it easy by putting a list up for people is...
Apparently, I got into a little bit of a kerfuffle a few years ago. By the way, it's been 5 years since I joined Twitter. I joined in 2008, and I just had my Twitterversary. And I was remembering some stuff, and Fred may or may not remember this because I don't remember exactly when it was. But one of the things that does bother me is when people give gift cards. It feels so incredibly impersonal to me. And I've had other people say, you're stupid. It's not impersonal. It's someone giving you money so you can go out and buy whatever the hell you want. And it's like, yeah, I know, but that's kind of what makes, to me, it feels like it's very impersonal. It's like they didn't even try. It's like, I can't figure out what to get them, so I'm just going to get them a Visa gift card. You know, here's $25. Go have fun. So I posted something about that on my blog years ago, and I remember several people going, you know, just no, you're ungrateful, and it's, at least they're giving you something, and well, I'd almost rather have them, you know, say, hey, for your present, I couldn't figure out anything to get you, so let's have lunch together. I'm going to give you my time.
I can see that.
Yeah, I would much rather that than them give me a $20 Starbucks thing. So I don't know, but the reason I bring that up is because of the wish list. I actually built my first Amazon wish list because of my family essentially having an intervention going, no one knows what to buy you. No one. You're impossible to buy for. And then they went the next step and they said, and you go to all this trouble to buy gifts for everybody. You like think it through. Every gift you give is perfect. You make us all feel like shit. We want you to build a list. And so I started building like an Amazon wish list, and I would share that with my family every Christmas, and so that I wouldn't get gift cards. So that's kind of how that came to be.
Wow. Yeah. So no, I understand that completely. I mean, that was the main reason that I started doing a wish list as well was, you know, and I'm looking at mine now and I'm realizing there's stuff up here from the last couple of years that never got picked up, including the Parabolas of Science Fiction, which I only put up there because of Mr. Stevens, and I still don't have a copy. So
I have that book.
Yeah, I don't.
It's fascinating.
So Fred, what about you? Your list has to be insane.
I not only have a list that probably rivals John's, but I broke it out into multiple lists. So you have fantasy, you have science fiction, you have history, you have movies, you have music. And then history is broken out by World War I, World War II.
And do you give that list to your family?
Oh, they all know about it, but nobody pays attention to it.
Of course not.
my wife came to me and she's like, you've got too many lists. I said, but just pick something on it. I can't. So I made another list, a new one called Priority.
So I did have the first year that I had all these things on my list. My cousin, who is like an older sister to me, I had put all the seasons of Smallville on there because I was digging that show at the time. I think there was only like three or four. And she goes out and she buys me season three. Not one. Three. And her logic was, well, I thought maybe someone else would get you one, and maybe someone else would get you two, so I'd get you three. Okay.
Well, she was thinking.
Yeah, she was. Yeah.
She was thinking of you.
Yeah, I was thinking I just wanted somebody to save me.
Oh, please. So, yeah, one of the other things that's been that was on my list from last year, which I just realized I don't have. For some reason, I thought I had this book, was the... the Fables Encyclopedia that Jess Nevins did for the Bill Willingham, Mark Buckingham comic series from Vertigo.
Oh, my God. Aren't they on like 90 volumes at this point?
Of the comic?
Yeah.
Well, it's coming to a close. I think it's only going up to issue 160. And I'm pretty certain this is the last hard arc that they're in right now. They just did a digital-only, started a digital-only miniseries just about Bigby Wolf. But yeah, they've been sort of wrapping a lot of stuff up. They actually kind of brutally killed a couple characters off in the last few issues that I was not expecting. But yeah, so Jess Nevins turned his attention to the Fables universe, which is always fun. And I just realized that has still been on my list for a while. So it's at some point I'm going to have to pick that up when I am once again gainfully employed.
Hate to say it, Jeff, I think I actually own that one.
Really? That's good.
I probably bought it because you mentioned it last year.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got to Fables I'm caught up on. Ferris I haven't. That's I've been trying to there's a few books that I'm several months behind on that I really want to pick up on. But one of the ones that I've been behind on has been the Hellboy BPRD universe, which has just been exploding, and there's been all kinds of books and collections of those that have been coming out, including a lot of original material that isn't, you know, just collections of the comic. There's been like some actual novels that have come out, and there's been a few special hardcovers of books that have been happening. And of course, there is finally the BPRD Hellboy crossover, which takes place early in Hellboy's career, that just started from Dark Horse, that I'm going to be hopefully getting a trade paperback of that at some point. But I've been so behind on trades. And there's still a few art books, like the Ian Miller book I still don't have, and the John Harris one I don't have.
Those are nice.
Yeah, I've seen them. Very nice. I've seen them both. They're gorgeous. But I tend to, my wish list always tends to veer towards art books and stuff like that. So normally stuff that sometimes is kind of difficult to find in the book and mortar stores. Because that's one thing I've noticed, is that SF art books tend to, you know, if it's not Halo, it tends not to make it to the shelf for all that long. So John, what do you have on your list?
Well, I've got 475 items, man.
Jeez. There you go. give me a couple.
but to pick a couple out.
Give me your top ones.
The two, I mean, it's funny. I mean, what I often weirdly find myself asking for are academic books, because they're expensive. Like, I can get a hold of graphic novels, and I can probably buy novels here and there. But academic stuff is just wicked expensive for the most part. And there are a couple that came out recently that I would really like to get my hands on. And one is Howard Siegel's Utopia as a Brief History, in which he attempts the utterly impossible, which is to tell a history of the concept of utopia. And he tries to go way back, you know, far beyond the employment of the term. And he also tries to look for ideas of utopia that you might see outside of, say, the Western canon. So it just sounds like such an impossible task that I have to read this book and see what he tried to do and how he did it. And Utopia is a very relevant sci-fi topic, so it seems like a good thing to put on this kind of list. I also would really like to get a copy of J.R.R. Tolkien's Beowulf translation, even though his son edited it. But it sounds really interesting, because what they do is they take his translation, which he did not envision for publication, and they take a bunch of speeches, lectures he did later about it, and they try to sort of put some of that next to the text and talk about, they have Tolkien himself sort of talk about the text as you read it. So it sounds like a fascinating thing to read. And I am a total Beowulf nerd, so that would be a great Christmas gift for me.
You are, because you just pronounced Beowulf two different ways.
Oh, did I do Beowulf too?
Yeah.
Whoops. I'm terrible. I'm so terrible. I mock myself. So there's that. And then there are two novels that I've not been able to get my hands on yet that I would love. And one of them is Paul Park's All These Vanished Engines, which came out this summer. And is sort of a postmodern memoir, science fiction, alternate history, historical exegesis. Now, how could I not want to read that?
Yeah, really. Precisely.
give me a second. I'm looking at Exo-Jesus.
Not an external Jesus. Exegesis, not Exo-Jesus.
Yeah. Okay, either way, I'm going to look it up, and then I'll tell you what I think.
Okay. And then I'll just throw out one more for now. It's a graphic novel called Beautiful Darkness. It's by Fabian Veilman, I think the author's name is. And it's the story of a bunch of little people who live in a dead girl's body.
Oh, lovely.
And how they have to try to survive after she has passed away.
Oh.
And all the terrible things some of them do to stay alive.
All right. What was the author's name on that again?
Fabian Veilman.
Wow.
And it just sounds, intriguing. And the cover alone, I mean, the art looks very sort of cartoony, but there's an interesting kind of substance in the backgrounds, and the contrast looks like it might be a really compelling visual thing to look at. And the story just sounds so strange. It's like, I got to read it to see how you do that kind of story.
Yeah.
You know?
Hmm.
So,
yeah,
those are a few that are on my list.
You know, when you were talking about the Utopias book, there was one book that I got a few years ago that is something, and it's still up on Amazon. And when people come to me with the, you know, I don't know what to get somebody problem, and I think, especially, I say, do they enjoy post-apocalyptic fiction? And sometimes they'll say yes, and their eyes will bug out. There was a book that came out in 2010 by Max Page called The City's End. Subtitle, Two Century of Fantasies, Fears, and Premonitions of New York's Destruction.
And oh, wow.
It is a paperback. It's the size of a coffee table book, but it's paperback.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a good oversized paperback that basically gives the history of New York being damaged or destroyed in fiction, in the pulps, in science fiction movies, in comics. It's really good because it shows like a number of album covers that have used the trope, and it, you know, uses a lot of couple mm-hmm. fairly rare illustrations that are in it. I'm pretty certain there's one Virgil Finlay that I had never seen except in this book as well.
Mm-hmm.
I just checked on Amazon and they've still got it up and readily available. It looks like it's new for 26 and you can get it used for 10, but that's it's a fascinating book because number one, there are a lot of illustrations in it that show you, that give you a very, you know, a very tangible sensation of how the subject was treated. And it goes back to like, you know, 18th and 19th century satires and things like that, all the way up to Image Comics, which blew up New York, you know, on a monthly basis. So.
Do they have Scott McCloud's Destroy?
I do not know. I do not have the book in front of me. It was Yale University Press, so it came out.
I'd be very curious to see if he included that, because that was some major New York City destruction in that comic book.
Mm-hmm. I will check when we are done recording. So, Fred, what about you? Your copious list. What kind of things do you place at the top of it, hoping that you'll get someday?
Well, how about I work my way backwards and go to an area we haven't gone to so far?
Okay.
Films. Two films that I'd love to get is, first off, there's Terry Gilliam did a movie this year called The Zero Theorem. And Terry Gilliam did such weird, wonderful stuff with Monty Python on his own. I don't care what it's about. Did not what?
I told you once.
Moving on. The second one is, there have been many versions of the movie Dune, but there's one that we never saw, and they finally made a movie about it. So the director, whose name I cannot pronounce to save my life, Jodorowsky,
yep.
Did a treatment of Dune involving many of the people that later went on to work with Ridley Scott on Alien or with David Lynch on the film that came to be. But there's now a movie which was in the theaters, now is available as a DVD, called Jodorowsky's Dune. It involves the artwork by people like Chris Foss, whose work you saw in most recently in Guardians of the Galaxy, as well as models, costumes, all sorts of storyboards. And the film tells the story of the attempt to make the film, sort of like, speaking of Terry Gilliam, how he tried to make the Don Quixote movie. And there was a movie made about his attempt to make the movie.
Yeah.
So it's been getting lots and lots of rave reviews. So either of those, if I get them, I'll be very happy boy.
Have you seen either of them?
No. We don't. We are not, even though we have a couple of art theaters in the area, we are not blessed with them taking up films like this.
Ah.
So, they won't even show Rocky Horror anymore.
Oh, my, that's a crime against man.
Yes, exactly.
It's astounding.
Yep.
Yeah. Not even for Halloween?
Nope.
Wow.
Nothing.
Wow. Man, times change. So, Patrick, what kind of stuff do you put on your list that nobody pays attention to in your family?
All kinds of things, really. There's tons of comic books. So I use my lists for a couple different things, including my Kirkus posts. So in case you did not know this, comic book publishers are notorious for not ever sending arcs. There are very, very few arcs ever sent out. And usually they're only to the really high profile sites like, you know, Coming Soon and Comic Book Resources and those kinds of places. Now I see Blasters getting them and they're doing some stuff with them. So I don't really get any arcs. So every graphic novel that I review is one that I've bought except for one. The Brent Weeks one was actually sent to me by Tor or whoever it was, Orbit. So they actually did send that book to me, but for the most part, everything is something I buy. So a lot of times what I'll do is I'll go on Amazon and I'll look for graphic novels that are coming out that are going to appeal to me, and I'll add them to my wish list, and then I'll get them as I need them. So, for example, there is right now Jim Butcher's War Cry, which is a bridge graphic novel between when the council goes to war and they draft Dresden to become a warden, and he has to actually fight the war against the, I believe it was the Red and the Black Court. I can't remember which court the vampires was that went to war with the council. And so it's a standalone story, because he's done a couple of these now. He also did the Ghoul book that was a standalone straight for comics. And this is also one that went straight to comics. So it never was a short story. And it's supposed to detail Dresden being assigned a group of young wardens who are inexperienced and having to go off and fight the vampires with them. So that one looks really good. I want to get that. There is some other stuff. So if I go away from comic books that I'm looking for, I want the Hobbit Unexpected Journey Blu-ray extended. I don't know if you guys have seen that they do extended versions of the Hobbit movies.
Yeah, as they do with...
Yeah, and I have the second one, The Desolation of Smaug, which I just watched last night, and it blew me away, because I'm sitting there, and it was a completely different movie, I'm sitting there going, I don't remember any of this. It was great. So now I want the first one, Unexpected Journey. I also got into a gaming phase here recently. And so I've been looking at different kinds of board games, because I remember, I think I told you guys before we were recording about Wonderland Comics, in the Tower District in Fresno, which was adjacent to where I went to elementary school, there was a place called the Game Preserve. Talk about Nirvana. My friends and I would go in there, and they had every game you ever wanted in your life. They had Fortress America. They had Axis and Allies. They had different versions of Risk. We didn't even know there were different versions of Risk existed. They had Shogun, which later I think was changed to something. They changed the name to Samurai or something like that, but yep. They had the original, which was Shogun. They had Buck Rogers in the 21st Century. They had all these different games that we just drooled over and none of us could afford, right? So flash forward to last year, and I'm dating and heavily into this relationship, and I'm spending a lot of time with her in her town, and we're going to this game store, and they had some of the coolest stuff around. And so I really got into wanting to play those kinds of games again. So I've added a couple to my wish list, including the Warhammer 40K Relic board game. I don't know if Fred knows anything about that.
No, I don't know.
No.
Is it fantasy or 40K?
It's Warhammer 40K. It's the 40K, yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's the 40K. So it looks super cool, oh. and I added that to my list. I also added Dungeons & Dragons Legend of Dritz.
That Rizzed I know. Yep.
Board
yep.
game. Mm-hmm. So I thought those two were kind of cool, and I've added them to my list. Yeah, there's the
TSR ones, the Legends of Drizzt, and I think there's like maybe one or two before and after. Those have gotten very, very favorable reviews and are very good for replay, and I know a lot of friends of mine really enjoy them. So
I literally Friday, I heard an interview as I was driving into work on the radio with someone who has written a book, and I think that this might appeal to John, and he might even know what the book is, but it's Ooh. About the friendship between Tolkien and Lewis, but it's a new book. There's one that's from like 2003 or 2008 or something like that, but this apparently is a new one. And I want to say it's like the literary lives of the Inklings or something like that. I wanted to write it down and I couldn't because I was in the car at the time, but it sounded like such a great book. And the person doing the interview was so excited by it and had read an arc, I guess. And just, they said they learned so much about the two and the letters that they wrote to each other and the time they spent together. And it just sounded so wonderful. And I really wanted to pick that book up.
Yeah, I wonder what. I mean, there's actually several books about that. I mean, I think the best known one is Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, The Gift of Friendship.
This is a new one. This is
yeah.
a new one.
But there's a couple of new books coming out. I wonder which one it is. There's On the Shoulders of Hobbits. Hmm. And then there's A Hobbit, A Wardrobe, and A Great War.
I honestly don't know. Neither one of those sound familiar.
Yeah, I wonder. There's also The Fellowship.
Well, and while we were recording, I went to the website looking to see if I could find it, and they don't have it. They don't have it listed. What did you find?
The Oxford Inklings, their lives, writings, ideas, and influence by Colin Duriez, March 2015.
That could be it.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, and it sounded wonderful. It sounded like a great, great book.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. You know, when you were talking about gaming, I was, I started having pity for the, families of people who are big into board games, because if it's tough to buy for science fiction book readers or comic readers, I can only imagine what it's like for if you have to go and see what board games they already own and
sure.
Versions and modules and stuff like that.
Well, and it's funny because my brother is staying with me, helping with mom, and he found some of the board games I have in the basement, and he said he wanted to play a game, but he's like, I don't want to play any of those weird games that you have in the basement. He's like, I want to play a real game. And I said, well, what's a real game? Because essentially in the basement, I have Axis and Allies, and I have my Star Wars version of Monopoly, and Buck Rogers, and a couple other. And he's like, oh, I don't want to play any of those. I want to play a real game. I'm like, wait. He's like, well, I would play real Monopoly. I said, it is real Monopoly. It's just got Star Wars theme. And so I actually went upstairs into my closet and I dug out the Monopoly game that I have carried with me ever since I left home, when I grew up and moved out. And it was the game that he and I played when we were younger. And I pulled that out and set it down on the table and said, here. And he's like, holy crap, you still have that? Yes, I still have it. Let's play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes I feel bad for my wife because she loves board games, and I was never wired for them at all. So,
did you see the Doctor Who Yahtzee?
Yes.
No, I haven't seen that.
There's two different versions that I've seen. One is where it's the cup is a TARDIS, and one is the cup is a Dalek.
Wow. Yeah, I used to play Yahtzee. I used to play Yahtzee, and I used to play cribbage. So
my grandmother, it was Yahtzee and Scrabble. And my brother, after staying with us since August and every night seeing me and because my mom watches Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune every night. So just when I'm coming home from work and start to do the cooking, Jeopardy's on. And after seeing me answer so many Jeopardy questions and so many Wheel of Fortune puzzles, he refuses to play Scrabble with me.
Your Trivial Pursuit.
Yeah.
He refuses Trivial Pursuit as well. Yes. Uh-oh. Yes.
But that's a real board game.
It is. Yeah. But he won't do it. And I even have the dirty version. Yeah. Someone bought for me years and years and years ago. And he's like, no, that would just be awkward.
A friend of mine once pointed out that he read all the cards of the original Trivial Pursuit.
Mm-hmm.
And he figured out it was something like 64% of all the answers were knowable either through Hogan's Heroes, Star Trek, or Monty Python. That enough,
I know nothing.
Yeah, enough history and enough, you know, enough pop culture and historical references and things like that are mentioned in those three shows that it constitutes 64% of the answers of the show. So, and of course, those were his three favorite shows, so he won every game. So, I got one thing that's on my list that I put up on my list recently. There was a book that came out over the summer called Substrata. And it was an art book. It was put out by Udon Press. And the subtitle was Open Source Fantasy. It was edited by Paul Richards. And what he did, and this is brilliant, because I love, even though I don't play a lot of video games, I love the art books involved with video games. Mm. And I will scoop them up just to get design ideas and stuff like that. And I'm fascinated by you know, the visual representations that these people develop. And even when you look at the books that like Stephen Martinaire puts out and stuff like that, there's always a lot of gaming design stuff in the back. Not so much full blown paintings, but you know, design work that he had done. James Gurney does a lot of that as well, and I just love the graphic aspect of it. So there are this book Substrata was this guy Paul Richards got together 80. Video game artists and said no committee, no Bible, nothing, just give me your best work. And a lot of the work for the book was original. It was, I think there's some reprints in there, but most of it was original stuff. And you can find free samples of this stuff online for this book Substrata, and it is just gorgeous. And it breaks my heart sometimes, because every time I get lured back into watching a science fiction movie, I tend to criticize the fact that art design seems to have stopped with the late 80s, and that I hadn't really seen a lot of, you know, full blown, well done, you know, design for just oddball things like sets and corridors and stuff like that. Something really, really compelling. And then you look at some of the set pieces that are in these books and you just, you know, tears come to my eyes. I saw, oh, these are just gorgeous. I would love to see more stuff like this in either comics or movies or whatever, as opposed to just video games.
Well, I find it interesting that you use that to sort of inspire your own art. I think listeners may or may not be aware that you and I do the Wednesday Doodle thing. Uh-huh. And, you know, of course, I'm always inspired by the art of XKCD. So I want to throw out there, if you have someone on your list who is a fan of older kind of sci-fi pulpy kind of art, like, oh, I don't know, just pulling a name out of my head, John DiNardo, there is a 2015 Pulp Attack calendar. Have you seen that?
I've seen ones from previous years.
It's pretty sweet. There's that one, and there's also Worlds of Fiction 2015, which is old movie posters, the pulp kind of movie posters. And those two things I saw, and they kind of caught my eye. And usually there's always like oh, what's his name? Vallejo?
Yep, yeah, Boris Vallejo.
Yeah, usually they always have a calendar out. There's always a Tolkien calendar and a George R. R. Martin calendar. I think last year it was, or the year before it was John Picasso, but I don't know who's doing it this year. And the Hildebrandt brothers are always doing like cool art posters or calendars. So usually there's like really cool calendars you can get for people.
Yeah, there was a Asgard Press used to do oversized like 11 by 17 calendars. And they did them on a number of subjects, but they always did one on vintage science fiction covers,
mm-hmm.
with a lot of, you know, Astounding and Air Wonder stories and stuff, right. like that. And I used to get those on a regular basis. And they also do them for sports and towns and places and stuff like this. And I think they started doing them of old romance covers as well. And the reason they're nice is because they're oversized, but they are spiral bound at the top. So that, you know, they hang flat, but also they're perforated at the very top.
Yes.
So you can frame these things.
And they still do that, yeah.
And you can get a really nice, I mean, you can get a 11 by 17 frame at Walmart for $250, and you can, you know, pop, you know, start popping these up on your wall. I've got a few, yep. kicking around my studio here. But yeah.
Well, I have an original Patterson on my wall.
Oh, yes, you do. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
About that. Yeah, a print of that sold at the local gallery recently. I was
nice.
quite happy with that.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so when I was at both Worldcon last year in Texas and World Fantasy this year in DC, I spent a lot of time going through some of the art books. I anytime there's a bookseller that's selling a lot of vintage science fiction or fantasy art books, primarily from the late 70s, early 80s, which is when a lot of advances in printing happened, and you could do these books at a fairly high quality. I would scoop those up whenever I could, and I grabbed a couple this year from a while back. But I'm always looking for new art books to sit and peruse. They are always fun. And speaking of art,
Garfunkel?
Art Garfunkel, yes. He's, as you know, a big hair on that man back in the day. So, one of my favorite artists from back in the day was Jim Starlin. And Jim Starlin did most of the first wave of the cosmic stuff that Marvel was doing. He did Warlock, and he did a bit of Captain Marvel, and he did The Death of Captain Marvel, the big oversized trade paperback. And he was also the guy behind all of the various Thanos crossover books that occurred, the Infinity Gauntlet and the Infinity War, and a few others. And he just put out a brand spanking new comic about Thanos called The Infinity Revelation, which is it's a decent size. I want to say it's close to 50 pages, if it isn't that, where Thanos, who has been at the forefront of a lot of different, you know, Marvel comics in the last couple of years, goes on a little quest. And it also happens to have Adam Warlock in it, who's one of my favorite characters. And Pip the Troll shows up at one point, and I'm really hoping Pip the Troll gets shown in the Marvel Cinematic Universe at some point. I really hope he does. But it was interesting reading the book because, given all the stuff they've done with the Marvel Cosmic Universe and the fact that the tone of those books has changed so much since guys like Dan Abnett took it over from when Starlin was doing it, it was very odd seeing these characters drawn by Starlin again. It would be like if Paul McCartney decided to do an album of death metal, you know. It's so disconcerting to see, you know, Starlin, instead of playing in his own sandbox, basically having to, you know, now deal with the fact that it's somebody else's sandbox to play in. And it's kind of fascinating. And it's a standalone book, and he's done a few other things for Marvel lately, but it was kind of fun reading this. It was one of the more oddball SF books that I've seen come out. There have been a few SF books that I've been and fantasy books that I've been kind of wrapping my head around lately. The two I wanted to mention were Jeff Parker's been doing a new series of Flash Gordon, which is up to about issue 7, I think, right now. And it's been pretty fascinating. As I have been roundly disappointed with just about every comic book attempt to do Flash Gordon, with the exception of the Al Williamson adaptation of the awful movie I love that adaptation. If I had read that adaptation and then gone to see the movie, I really would have been pissed off. But the the new book by Jeff Parker is really good. I mean, most of the art is based on fairly classic designs. He's really not trying to experiment all that much like DC did with that awful book they did in the early
'90s.
And this is probably my favorite. This is probably my favorite take on the character that I've seen in a while. Clearly, you know, probably since the Filmation cartoon, to be honest with you. So,
wow.
Did you like the DC book?
Yes.
Really?
I did. I was so upset when it was just a limited series and never came back.
Is that the one where Ming had the skull on his face, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And Flash Gordon was an NBA star because the NBA was big at the time.
Yes. Oh my God.
Yeah. I really enjoyed that. That was one of my favorites. I still have that.
Really?
Matter of fact. Yeah.
I couldn't stand that.
It's over there in the corner in the closet. Yeah. But yeah, that I loved that because it was so much better than that freaking movie.
Yeah.
And you know, but that I know that's not saying much. But yeah, that and then there was just recently a Flash Gordon that was like the one before this.
Yeah,
that I liked.
That was the one where it had a very interesting take, and basically it was the fact that Ming brought Mongo to Earth primarily to hook up with Hitler.
Right.
And
there was
a lot of Earth-based storylines that went on it, where the sons and daughters of all the various princes of Mongo put together this little, you know, undercover squad to go find Earth and find the people who were in charge of the war and stuff like that. And
right.
It was interesting. Yeah. I will admit that it was interesting.
Yeah. There were agents from Mongo on Earth.
Yes. Trying to go undercover with giant wings. Cause you know, it's easy to put a lion man in disguise, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. and yeah, it was those characters from the old pulp, comic.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting. And then it's like as soon as that was over, they started this other new reboot, and I'm going, oh, it's just reboot mania. You know, they're just rebooting him to reboot him, or they're probably just rebooting it to maintain the license.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But the series you were talking about was Zeitgeist.
Yes.
And I actually did review that for Kirkus back in 2013. I thought that was decent.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. But the new one's been pretty good. It's been quite a bit of fun. Of course,
Jeff. I was also a fan of the 4-issue reboot of Aquaman where he puts on the blue costume.
I didn't mind that.
Yeah, I like
that. That was actually a pretty good book.
Mm-hmm.
So one other classic artist who I wanted to mention, playing in old sandboxes again, Walt Simonson, who did so many great books, and who's known for his classic run of Thor for Marvel, has been kind of revisiting Thor with a book called Ragnarok, which is sort of his own. It's almost like a post-apocalyptic take on the Asgardians. But he gets to play with a lot of his favorite characters and give them new designs, and all the designs he's using are pretty much classic Walt Simonson. So it's kind of nice to see him, you know, playing with familiar characters, even though he's not playing with the Marvel licenses anymore. And Simonson is also, they're reprinting Simonson's Star Slammers, which Fred mentioned before the show, which was a great book he did for, that was Epic, the Epic line that Marvel had for a while, where they were dealing with a lot of, you know, breaking out of the comic book universes and trying to play with more science fictional aspects. It was a nice little space opera that he did for them.
But you mentioned the tone of the books changing. And it's interesting that you say that because, and I'm curious what John and Fred think. There's a lot of people who say that science fiction, as far as actual novels and stuff go, has lost the hope of the future. But it seems like, at least in the Marvel universe, they're bringing back some of the hope and some of the joy, like they did with Guardians of the Galaxy. They made it fun again. Do you guys find that to be true? Do you think that science fiction literature has lost the hope of the future, and that's why we get is dark, gritty, post-apocalyptic, and all this kind of crap now?
Everything goes in and out of favor.
Yeah, there's cycles. There's definitely cycles.
I mean, it never goes totally to zero.
But why are we in the let's depress the hell out of everybody cycle right now?
Because that's popular among the movies with Hunger Games and stuff. And
so what you're saying is we're
fiction
in the,
and whatever.
We're in the cycle of emo sci-fi?
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, a lot of my collection is quote-unquote hopeful science fiction. I've been buying it all along. It hasn't gone totally away. It's just not as prominent on the shelves, so you got to hunt a little more.
So in Star Wars 7, C-3PO is going to be all in black, smoking cigarettes behind the cantina.
No, but that's J.J. Abrams. He's not emo. If it was maybe the guy that did Dragon Tattoo or something.
Lars Degard, whatever his name was.
I think that's an accurate pronunciation of his name.
I'm thinking of the film.
Oh.
Yeah.
Which one? The original or the American reboot?
The original more, but you know, that would be more the look I would say for emo Star Wars.
I would totally watch that movie.
Emo Star Wars?
Yeah. Emo Star Wars.
What's the name of the guy who did the Hellboy movies?
Del Toro.
Del Toro. Imagine if he did Star Wars.
Well, we'd get some decent monsters at least. So.
Yeah. Pac Rim 2 is coming. That's
true. Which would be nice. But you bring up a good point, and I'm wondering how that plays to comics. And I know that John's been reading a lot of older arcs, as well as John likes to pick and choose his arcs and read an entire run at once. And when it comes to the more science fictional aspects of it, do you think he's got a point there when it comes to that we're seeing? The way I used to describe it was science fiction comics always never even bothered trying to keep up with science fiction in general.
And yeah, I think they're usually like a generation behind.
Yeah.
I mean, they've evolved more slowly. I mean, if you look at mainstream science fiction comics like Legion of Superheroes, like they evolve more slowly because they're wedded to these older narratives and they're supposed to be continuations of those histories. So unless you do a total reboot, you've got to keep some of that increasingly antiquated both ideas and visual stuff in the book. And then with shorter things like what do we read like a year or two ago, the Singularity series.
Hypernaturals.
Yeah, the Hypernaturals. Like that was that came across to me as really flat because he didn't go far enough. He just used a lot of these concepts as sort of like new superpowers or new superhero conceits and didn't really take it far enough for me out of the superhero genre to make it really interesting as potentially as science fiction. And I see that a lot with science fiction comics. I mean, sometimes people do something really new, like Warren Ellis with trees. That's a really far out concept. It's not super scientific. I mean, he tries to be sciencey, but I mean, I don't see that as super scientific, but as sort of dealing with, changes, alien changes to the Earth and stuff like that, it's really interesting. But that, for that, he took a really fresh concept and had to run and ran with it. And I don't think that happens often enough in science fiction comics.
But that's also a good example of when you mentioned Ellis, I mean, I think about, we talked about Transmetropolitan before and the fact that that was about as dystopian as you can get, but that was also probably his funniest book when it came to just the sheer amount of satire that he shoehorned into it when it came to politics and social issues and stuff like that.
Yeah, and he does that. He takes dystopias and apocalypses and finds other things in them.
Right.
He does that with Freak Angels.
Oh, Freak Angels. Yes.
Freak Angels.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
So Freak Angels is set in an apocalypse.
Yes.
But it's a really odd apocalypse.
Yeah.
And the more you find out about what's going on, the more you find out how weird it is. And he finds a lot of interesting themes to mine in it as well. And when people do that with science fictional themes in comics, you get really amazing stuff. But like I said, it just doesn't happen often enough.
Well, yeah, you bring up a good point there, and I always go back to the, you know, comics that tend to base themselves on space opera templates, which is something I was always critical of with a lot of the Marvel stuff, and the fact that they, you know, they were still dealing with, you know, great big empires of green aliens, you know.
Right.
and we've seen, there's been a lot of, you know, space-based books that have been coming out. And like Fred mentioned, a lot of them have been straight ahead horror, and they've been good horror, and they've been, you know, serviceable dramas, but they're not doing anything really, really groundbreaking. And you look at, I think it's Dark Horse has been doing these multiple parallel miniseries of Alien, Predator, and Prometheus.
Does that even compare with Django Unchained crossing over with Zorro?
No, it does not. No, which is a brilliant book, which I did laugh at. But my point about the Alien, Prometheus, Predator crossover is the fact that okay, they're playing in a well established sandbox, and they've got some gorgeous art, and they're you know, co-opting a lot of the really spectacular design work that's come ahead of them, but the whole thing reads like fanfic. I mean, you know, the whole thing reads like, you know, that, you know, some Mary Sue cyborg shows up and is going to solve all the mysteries of the universe. It's like, you know, right. Come on, can we, you know, I appreciate the effort, guys, but can you, you're not making Prometheus any more compelling. Okay. You're not doing anyone any service here, which is too bad. It really is.
What was the first independent comic you read?
The first independent comic?
Non-Marvel, non-DC.
Well, that would go back to the Gold Keys back when I was a kid.
Really?
Yeah. The Gold Key and then Atlas Press, all the stuff that Atlas did with Samson, the Commandy ripoff called Samson, where he lives in New York. And a lot of those books. There was that one... There was one that Atlas did. It was a Swamp Thing ripoff, but it took place in like the world of Fahrenheit 451. I want to say it was called something like Morlock 2001, I think it was called. It was a really dumb title. But it was a fascinating book. It was this big giant tree creature that's, you know, roaming this, you know, it was a neat idea where you take suddenly, okay, here's your dystopia, and now in the middle of it, we're going to throw this, you know, this monster that you know, sprays acidic sap at you and stuff like that. It was a neat little, it was the first time that I'd seen like two tropes mingled that well in a book. It didn't last long, but there was a few Gold Key books that I always got because of those gorgeous painted covers that they always had. And then my second wave going into books, I pretty much jumped on Dark Horse right when it started, right from the start, because I don't think they had one loser in their whole lineup when they started.
When did they start?
Oh, good Lord, that's a good question.
For me, it was Eclipse.
Yeah, I did read a lot of Eclipse.
DNA Agents, Crossfire.
Yeah,
which actually shared the same universe.
And what about Comico with Justice Machine and and who did Elementals? It's the Bill Willingham book Elementals. Who published that?
Didn't Comico do Elementals?
I think it was Comico, because I know there was a crossover with those. I mean, Elementals was for the way they built their arcs and stuff like that. That was a spectacularly written book. I didn't care for the whole big, you know, vampire storyline that they did. But where they started bringing in, you know, Asgardian gods and international heroes and stuff like that it got really fun. Comico. Dark Horse was 86, by the way.
Okay. So, yeah, and the Eclipse stuff I was reading was probably in 82, 83, somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever read, like, comic book resources or their blog, Comics Should Be Good?
Yeah.
They, not too long ago, tripped me out with a comic book Legends Revealed, where the DNA agents crossed over with the Teen Titans.
Yes.
And no one knew it.
Yes.
They kept it a secret. The two writers for the two books.
Yeah.
That tripped me out. I love that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I do. I love when they do that and they Easter egg it, you know, a little bit. That's great stuff.
It just dawned on me. Comico was where Grendel started as well.
Oh, I remember Grendel.
Yeah.
That's right.
They just did a Grendel Shadow crossover that Matt Wagner wrote, which was really good. Good time travel story.
The space opera-y kind of stuff that goes on in comic books can be good and bad. Again, one of the series that I really enjoyed, and apparently I was the only one, was the second Atari Force series from DC. Yes. With the kids.
Yep.
I thought that was just a fantastic series, and I don't think anything has ever happened with those characters ever since. But that was a great. Do you guys remember Atari 2600?
Oh yeah.
And if you bought certain games, you got the little mini comic book in them, and it was the Atari Force. And the whole premise behind this one series was that the quote unquote the heroes of that series, this was their kids.
Hmm.
Which reminds me that apparently I have a thing for that particular trope, because the other series from DC that I really, really enjoyed that didn't last that long was Infinity Inc.
Yep.
And that was the kids of the Justice Society.
Yeah, that lasted pretty long.
Oh, and you know who drew that?
That was McFarlane.
Todd McFarlane.
For a while, yeah.
Yeah, before, that was before where Spider-Man.
That was where he really caught everyone's eye with, especially there was one story arc he did involving Our Man.
Mm.
Where they're trying to stop Our Man from doing something that they think is going to cause damage, and all the panels were arranged in a giant hourglass on this one page. It was really nice.
Well, and that series happened and during Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Yep.
And if I remember correctly, the kids survived, but basically were told that no one was going to remember their parents or their contribution.
Yeah.
And it's like, that just hit me at the time. I was like, whoa,
That's
so deep. Dude.
Not a lot of times you can talk about anything crisis related and say it's too deep. So,
yeah.
Except for Tommy Tomorrow, the whole Commandy Tommy Tomorrow thing I always did enjoy. Comico, I also just, when I looked at the screen here, was they were doing the Doug Wildey Johnny Quest book for a while, which lasted, I want to say, about 26 issues. And had a whole pile of great artists on it. Adam Kubert was on it. Steve Rude. Dave Stevens was doing the cover for that book for a while. And they were also the first ones that brought back Space Ghost for a comic before who was it who picked it up later? Was it Image? Someone did that gorgeous painted miniseries of Space Ghost, the unironic miniseries that I really liked, which was a really good origin story for him.
There was also an independent comic that I got through a trade, and I did not trade very often, but my brother was dating someone and she had a brother who was into comics, and he really wanted to look at my comic books and try to figure out if there's anything that of mine that he wanted. And I forget what it was. There was something that he really wanted. And he's like, here, you know, you can look through any of these comics. And there was one. It was like a space pirate.
Star Slayer?
It may have been Star Slayer.
Yeah.
And I just remember being probably 11 or 12 years old. And I opened up this comic book and there are naked people in it. And I went, this one.
That's
right here. This one.
That's Mike Grell's Star Slayer.
Yeah. I'll trade you this one right here. This one, please. And he's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, that was a good book.
Mm-hmm.
That was where Grimjack got started, was in the back of Star Slayer.
You said that?
So. John mentioned Beowulf before. John, did you ever read the DC Beowulf from the mid-70s?
I'm pretty sure I did. I may be trying to block out of my memory, but I'm pretty sure I did.
Yeah, there was one great little period of about 3 months, maybe 4 or 5 months, where DC started their own line of fantasy books, and they did one.
Right.
Steve Ditko did a great one called Stalker about a flat planet and this kid that sells his soul to become the greatest warrior. And there was the Beowulf, and there was a couple other ones, and I want to say Mike Grell was on one of those as well, but I do not remember.
Wasn't there something about the sword only being, you could only wield Beowulf's sword if you were pure of heart in the DC comics?
Oh, there might be. Now I got to go back and read them.
Thanks.
I remember it being like a powerful mystical talisman or something like that that people were always trying to steal and get a hold of.
Yeah, I just remember it was great because they did a. It was one of those books that really got me because it was using larger panels. It would do fight scenes in larger panels, which a lot of books at the time weren't. I mean, if you read Justice League back at the time, you were getting, you know, 6 panels per page minimum. And, you know, if you got a half page spread for a fight scene and stuff like that, that was, you know, that was a big deal. You really didn't have a lot of pinup pages unless it really, really warranted it. They crapped a lot of story into those books.
And you were right. It was Star Slayer, The Log of the Jolly Roger. That was it.
Yep, that was it.
Mike Grell, published by Pacific Comics.
Yep. Good book. So, Patrick, what's been on your radar lately, comic-wise?
Oh, my goodness. Well, again, most of what I read is geared towards my posts over at Kirkus. So I've been looking at a lot of the fresh kind of stuff that we've been talking about, you know, so Captain Marvel and Guardians of the Galaxy, on my short list for upcoming stuff on Kirkus. I've got the Black Widow Volume 1. I want to get Velvet Volume 1.
Oh, Velvet's so good.
I want to get Drafted. Not literally. because I heard that someone's going to make that into either a TV show or a movie or something. So I want to pick that book up. And I really enjoyed what Gail Simone did on Red Sonja. So she did another book called The Legends of Red Sonja. I want to get that one. Really good. And then just as one of my favorite characters, and I think that he became one of my favorite characters during the West Coast Avengers run, was Moon Knight.
Yeah. Yes.
And I saw that there's a new Moon Knight,
yep.
From the dead or something like that is what it's called. And I'm really interested in that. It's from Warren Ellis. I want to check that out.
Yeah, and that's being continued by Jason Aaron, I think. Jason Aaron picked it up after that with the same artist.
I would love to get into some of the, you know, I know Fred talks about kind of where do you start with some of this stuff because it can be a little bit confusing. I would love to get into some of the new Green Hornet and Kato kind of things that they've been doing, but there's so many different versions. There's Kevin Smith's version and there's the Seth Rogen version. Then there's the continuation of the TV show version. And there's this and that. I don't even know where to start at this point, but I would love to get into that.
I think Chris Roberson wrote that book called Masks, which was Justice Inc., The Shadow and Green Hornet and all those guys kind of sharing a storyline. That was pretty good.
Well, I'm also interested in Wending and Adam Christopher. Chuck Wending and Adam Christopher have a book coming out that I want to check out as well. A comics book. Sentinel, yep.
Has anyone been reading Annihilator by Grant Morrison?
No.
Nope.
Sorry.
All right. That's the burden I'll take on myself then. So, Fred, anything new been popping up on your radar since last time we spoke?
I picked up Star Trek, the ongoing series. They had several volumes on sale. Comixology right now is doing their 12 days of Advent, a free comic each day.
Who's publishing Star Trek right now?
I think IDW?
Yes. Okay.
I think. And Flash Gordon, the first volume was free. So I assume that's the same one you were talking about, Jeff.
I think so.
So I got several of the Star Treks. I also got the complete run of City on the Edge of Forever, the Harlan Ellison episode done as he, I am told, originally envisioned it.
So in other words, the correct way.
Yeah, it's his script. They built it off his script, yeah.
Yep. And otherwise, a number of subscriptions continue, like Guardians of the Galaxy, Rocket Raccoon, Supreme Blue Rose, The Fuse, Copperhead, and many, many others, more than I realize at times.
Yeah. Do you remember when Rocket Raccoon went into his room only to find Gideon's Bible?
Oh, good Lord.
Anybody read Grayson?
Nope. I've been dropping feces left and right. So.
I have always been a huge fan of Dick Grayson, if for no other reason than the fact that he had to put up so much with Bruce Wayne for so many years. And I'm hearing nothing but good things about that book. And, you know, they're doing a live-action Teen Titans that's going to feature Dick Grayson.
Really?
Yes.
I had not heard that.
A TV show.
Okay.
It's in development, and they are talking about it will be Dick Grayson's team. Oh. So we're talking about the original, like, Teen Titans.
Oh.
But he will be Nightwing, not Robin.
Hmm. So it'll be the George Perez Teen Titans, then.
Probably, yeah. I wish they would do Young Justice.
Too. Yeah, I'm still mad about Young Justice, and I really didn't need that wound reopened. Thank you, Patrick. I appreciate it.
Hey,
Merry Christmas to everyone.
It gets worse because I also have that wound, and then I saw that they added Young Justice to Netflix, and I was like, oh, Young Justice. And so I started watching it, and I binge watch it. And then I get to the last episode of season one, and it says, we also suggest you watch these. I'm like, they only gave me one season. They only gave me one season.
Season two was a masterwork in how to do a ensemble half hour drama.
I did just pick up the DVD for Legend of Korra Book 3 Changes, which is the season that midway through they said, you know what? Kids aren't watching this on Nickelodeon. Let's just move it to the website and take it off the air. And I'm sitting there going, why is my DVR not recording Korra anymore? What's going on?
Wow.
Yeah, so I got that whole DVD now. And I guess season four is also being streaming online. So.
Hmm. So, John, what about you?
I've been kind of poking around a little. Because I tend to read graphic novels. I tend to be a little behind the newest stuff, but
yeah.
I'm definitely interested in the new artist for Rat Queens.
Yeah,
they just replaced Rock. Keep wanting to call him Rock Sampson. They replaced the old artist with a new artist from Croatia whose name is Stjepan Sejic.
Yes,
I hope I pronounced that right.
I believe you did.
And he is an amazing artist. I mean, I liked the original artwork for the early Rat Queen stuff, but his art is really strong, and it's I think it's going to really do very well for the story that they're telling in the book. And I'm also interested in the fact that DC's doing a bunch of omnibuses of some of my favorite old stuff next year. There's going to be a Neil Adams Batman omnibus.
Yeah.
What else? There's one other one I was really interested in. Walt Simonson's Orion.
Yes.
Including some of the stuff from Jack Kirby's Fourth World.
Yeah.
That's going to be a real kick.
Yeah. That was a decent book. He picked it up. I think Byrne did it first and then Simonson took it up.
In Fourth World, right? Because the Orion series was all Simonson, I think.
Yes. Orion. Yes.
That's right.
Right. You're right.
So that should be a lot of fun. I'm curious to see where some series that are ongoing are going, like where Miss Marvel's going to go.
Forward.
Forward. Well, yes, forward. But G. Roy Wilson has done a really good job of keeping it pretty fresh. A little too adorable sometimes, but pretty fresh. So I'm really curious to see where that goes. But mostly I've been kind of keeping an eye out for graphic novel collections that are coming out that I want to pick up. And like I said, next year DC's doing several of them that I think will be interesting. They're even doing an Absolute Trends in Metropolitan, which seems like really excessive, but they're doing it. So, yeah.
Well, I can see the need for that. It'll be nice if it gets some traction again, you know.
Right.
Even though it does read as a touch dated.
I think we talked about that when we were talking about Alice, and it's great stuff, but it's feeling a little dated.
Yeah, if I was going to recommend anything for you right now, John, it would be Kurt Busiek series Autumnlands, Tooth and Claw. There's been two issues out, and the first one was an oversized issue.
Okay.
Really good post-apocalyptic animals running around in various tribes. And one that I've mentioned before is Birthright, which is the story of the family whose young son ended up going to the other world you know, in a very trope-like way. And as the family is imploding in the wake of that, the son shows up again as basically the other world's Conan. And comes back to the real world. And the impact that that has on the family. And there's a whole conspiracy going on behind it. But we get all these great flashbacks of what the other world is like. And it's a lot of fun.
Hey, Jeff.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Jeff, do you think John and Fred would like that really dense book I was telling you about not that long ago? First Kingdom?
Yeah, you told me about it.
No,
Jack Katz. Jack Katz, First Kingdom, Birth of Tundren.
They might for a history lesson, if nothing else.
It's a very dense book.
Yeah, I reread the first two volumes, I want to say 2 years ago. And there are some parts of it that you just wince at.
Yes.
But at the same time, with the exception of some of the artists who were working in the Warren books at the time, like the early Vampirella and Eerie and Creepy, and people like that, his art was so different than what anybody else was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was doing so much in black and white, he really kind of went a little crazy with the line work. But he still kept he wasn't trying to be overly artistic. He kept a very comic book aesthetic running through it.
But he was writing it to be a graphic novel. Every issue was a chapter in a overarching story.
Yep. Yeah, there was a few books, you know, back then. There was a few that Heavy Metal was putting out, and hell, even the early versions, the early editions of ElfQuest were done that way as well.
Oh, I remember ElfQuest. Yes.
Yeah, they were done as standalones that were going to be, you know, books in an arc as opposed to monthlies, floppies, pamphlets, whatever you want to call them.
Well, you look at the first versions of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah,
those were not. Those Archie comics. I mean, Archie completely changed those.
Oh yeah, those were gorgeous pieces of work in and of themselves. But we'll never get those back. I know those versions of the Turtles have made appearances in various multiverse stories that they've done either in the comics or in the cartoons, which is nice. At least it's nice to see somebody recognizing the fact that
I have some reprints.
It was designed somewhere. To be a dark satire of everything that was going on in the grim and gritty world of comics at the time. So
well, and I have reprints somewhere because they did reprint them for a little while.
Yeah, they did. But those were magazine sized when they came out too. So
yeah,
wow.
Because they were basically just putting them out themselves, Eastman and Laird.
Yeah, this is the sound of comic people nerding out. By the way. if you're curious.
Which is what caused Sarah Chorn to just completely tune out the other night. She's like, oh, you guys are talking about comics now. I don't know anything about comics. I don't care about comics. I'm gonna go off and do something else for a little while.
Yeah.
Let me know when you're done.
That's what she does. All right, so why don't we wrap it up here? We've got some really good ideas, and we've talked about a lot of stuff that isn't necessarily superhero-based in comics. I call that mission accomplished, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And as we are wrapping up the year, I wanted to throw it to my two co-hosts if they had any final thoughts. Fred, why don't you go first?
I'm hoping that sci-fi really becomes better at television next year with The Expanse. Although, from what I've heard of the Childhood's End miniseries, it doesn't sound like they're quite got religion yet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping to continue to find new, interesting new comics next year. And I hope to record lots of episodes, either with Patrick or with you guys next year. And I hope I don't get that much snow. So I have time to read instead.
John, what about you?
I have to read a lot more.
Well, I want you to write a lot more. So.
I'm going
to
write a lot more too, definitely. But this past year, mostly because of extenuating circumstances, I didn't do as much as I wanted to. But I'm looking forward to going forward more next year. And I'm kind of looking forward to it. I'm interested in actually some of the fantasy television that's coming out, like Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, the BBC is doing for next year. I heard that Good Omens might be getting put together too.
That's a radio show.
Was that a radio show?
Yeah, BBC.
I just heard like someone mentioned it and I didn't know what the format was.
Just like they did Neverwhere last year.
Okay, but like Pina Serafinowicz is doing something in it and it sounds like it could be pretty good. I'm looking forward to a lot of novels, looking forward to a lot of stuff next year, and I'm hoping it's an even more interesting year than this one was.
Yeah, this one certainly was interesting.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I want to mirror that because I personally want to get a lot more writing done, both on SF Signal and on my own. And I actually succeeded in reading a lot more, but I'm still so far behind the curve of people like Fred and Sarah. And
none of us can hope to beat Sarah.
I do not set my bar that high, but there are a few things that I want to get. There's a lot of books out right now that I really want to read and get through. And TV or movies, I'll give or take. I don't get too excited about either of them. But when something does strike my fancy, I do follow it. And there's a lot of neat stuff coming up. I mean, once we get to the beginning of next year is when the whole big giant return of Secret Wars occurs in Marvel. And this whole DC Futures End thing comes to a head. So hopefully we'll have some kind of considerable, measurable change that we can walk away with that makes the books a little better than they are right now, primarily for DC. DC really needs help. Marvel, I've been so on, but they've at least managed to put some good stuff out. And Patrick, what about you? What are the podcasting plans for next year?
Same as they always are, Pinky. Anilio and I are going to continue Functional Nerds. We think we've finally kind of figured out a format that really works for us, and people seem to be digging it, and our numbers for downloads are up. So why fix what's not broken?
Good point.
SF Signal continues on. One of the things that we added in 2014 was Jame Gates doing an episode a month where she does all the heavy lifting and goes out and gathers people and kind of puts them together and brings them to me, and we record and do stuff. And I think those have been a lot of fun. That's how I actually got to tell Tad Williams and Kate Elliott that they both wrote books that made me yell at their characters. To which they both said, good. Okay.
That's awesome.
So, I'm just going to continue doing that. Anilio and I will be at Capricorn in Chicago, so we're going to do some live stuff there.
When's that?
February.
Okay.
I already have my membership and my hotel room, at least for part of WorldCon in Spokane. The hotels were already booked by the time last month when I got my membership, which just tripped me out. So I have like partial time at WorldCon, but I'm hoping to be able to do some more live interviews there. And I always enjoy doing that there and at Mile High Con. It's fun to actually be able to get out and be face to face with someone and do an interview with them.
Mm.
And I love doing that kind of stuff. I do want to do more interviews for SF Signal. It just sometimes gets really hard. Other than that, you know, it's the usual stuff over there. We'll keep doing them as long as people keep listening.
Good. And you'll probably keep having us on against your better judgment. So.
Hey, if you reply to the email.
Yeah, that's true. So I do want to thank everybody who's been listening this year. I think we had a really good slate of shows this year. I've been exceedingly pleased with it. And we had a lot of great guests. And even though December doing three episodes is just killing me, I'll get over it. And we will
That's
be
so
back.
Cute.
We,
huh? That's so cute.
Yeah, it is.
Hey, I just want to say I've enjoyed the podcast. I think what you guys are doing at Skiffy and Fanti is pretty damn awesome. And I, for one, was thrilled to be invited on. So.
Our first episode.
Yeah, no kidding. Oh, man, that's funny. So, yeah, we've already got guests lining up. I don't want to say out the door, but, yeah, we've got more than I expected to have going into 2015. And we will be back and talking about all kinds of goodies. Our subject list is also starting to – we're getting to the point now where people are actually throwing subjects at us, and we're like, okay, I guess we can't come up with our – Say
Can
again?
I throw one at you? Can I throw one at you?
Sure.
I would love to have John Stevens do an academic treatise of the three-book trilogy by Chris Claremont that is a sequel to the Willow movie.
You'll break he his
wrote,
brain.
He wrote it based on notes given to him by George Lucas. I'd love to have
just
that.
Sounds like an terrible.
Wow.
Yeah. That'd be
you
great.
If there's audiobooks of those, I'd love to listen to them, but I ain't going to read them. So.
What if they were read by John DeLancey?
Ooh. Maybe. Maybe.
What if they were read by Finn Rizzell? Willow, concentrate.
So, yes, to our listeners, yeah, we all thought it'd be a good idea to have Patrick on this week.
It'll only happen
if you don't
once.
Get enough of us bantering. So, yeah, so I just wanted to thank everybody for listening this year. We've had a lot of good comments, and we get a lot of good feedback from people. And we're happy to keep doing it. And we intend on doing it through as far as we can, as long as we can manage, until something new and exciting takes over the podcasting world and we're sending thought casts to each other and the mental noise just becomes too great for anyone to take. So, but until that time, we are your faithful horsemen, and we hope you all have an excellent holiday season, and we will see you again in 2015.
Good Say goodnight,
night, gentlemen.
Good night.
Good night, gentlemen.
You know they can't actually see you.
Yeah.
It's like audio podcasting 101.
Yes. They know me well enough to know when I'm rapping. Everybody have a very good evening.